This is Micro News, the podcast where we, that's me, Laura, and Matt,
hello,
talk about some of the times microbiology has been in the news in the past month.
We're going to continue with not discussing the COVID-19 pandemic. We're sure you're aware of what's going on, and it's nice for us all to have a bit of a break from talking about it once in a while. So my first story is a pretty exciting one. Every year, malaria causes millions of deaths worldwide. In Africa, it caused 408,125 deaths in 2016 alone. Malaria is not a new disease. We've known about it for a long time. So why isn't there a vaccine for it? Well, malaria is caused by a parasite called Plasmodium. And this parasite is incredibly effective at evading immune responses, making developing a vaccine extremely difficult. But now there is an exciting study out of Brown University into malaria vaccines. Researchers screened blood samples from children who had natural immune resistance to severe malaria infections. They managed to identify an antibody to one of these malaria proteins called PFGARP that appears to protect resistant children from severe disease. Further study showed that the antibodies seem to activate a malarial self-destruct system, causing the parasite cells living inside human red blood cells to undergo a form of programmed cell death. Creating a vaccine from this antibody is particularly interesting as it's using a different way to kill the parasite, using the cell's own programming to kill itself. Although it's a long way off, it's incredibly exciting research.
Researchers have found that a bright purple species of bacteria could be used to control a number of crop diseases. The bacterium, called Chromobacterium phragmitis, was first described in the Microbiology Society's very own International Journal of Systematic and Evolutionary Microbiology last year. C. phragmitis was found in tidal marshes in Maryland and Virginia in the US. These marshes are home to a lot of wildlife, including mud turtles, white-tailed deer, and blue crab. The researchers who found the bacterium are from the Agricultural Research Service in the US and went onto the marshes to hunt for new biopesticides. Biopesticides are naturally occurring organisms that can be used as an alternative to chemical pesticides. So, biopesticides can be used as an organic method of pest control, and when effective and low-cost biopesticides are discovered, it's great for farmers. So far, the researchers are looking at whether C. phragmitis could be used to protect crops against insect pests, including the cabbage looper, seed corn maggot, and flower beetle. So far, their findings have been quite successful, with one strain completely fatal to immature cabbage loopers. These are leaf-eating, caterpillar-like pests. Back in 2003, microbiologist Phyllis Martin discovered another Chromobacterium species with insecticidal properties. This bacterium was later licensed to a commercial firm and marketed as a biopesticide. The bacterium isn't actually pathogenic to insects, but produces compounds that kill them, which is great because it means that live bacteria are not sprayed onto crops and insects away from the farmland won't be affected. This is a good example of a process called bioprospecting, which means searching for organisms that could be used as, or the source of, a commercially viable compound. Microorganisms are a great source of commercially viable compounds, be it medicines, enzymes to be used in industry, or in this case, biopesticides. Since Phyllis's discovery of Chromobacterium substigae in 2003, researchers have been looking at the genus with more interest, hoping to find more species with insecticidal applications.
So my next story is also about crops. According to the US Agency for International Development, about 2 to 3 million hectares of irrigated farmland go out of production worldwide due to salinity problems each year. Irrigation water contains salts that concentrate in the soil, and using fertilizers can also increase salinity. Researchers from Brigham Young University in the USA are studying how salt-tolerant bacteria could help crops increase their own salt tolerance. In a previous study, they isolated salt-tolerant bacteria from plants growing in salty soils and inoculated young seedlings with these bacteria and showed that the seedlings are exhibiting improved growth in high salt conditions compared to plants not inoculated with the bacteria. In the new work, they explored whether this salt tolerance could be transferred to other plants, which it turns out it can be. The research group are now looking to see whether they can inoculate additional plant crops with the bacteria.
So, Matt, with your marine biology background, you don't need me to tell you how important marine microorganisms are. But for the listeners at home, the microbes in our ocean produce over 50% of the planet's oxygen, They're food for whales, they influence the climate, and like I mentioned earlier, they're a major source of bioprospecting research for important discoveries. So yeah, marine microbes are hugely important in maintaining life in and out of the oceans. Research involving over 100 scientists worldwide will hopefully propel advances in plankton microbiology. In an effort to improve the understanding of plankton, which are single-celled microorganisms, or protists, researchers have investigated 39 economically important species of protists from the ocean. These included those related to algal blooms, but researchers have tried to investigate proteins from different branches of the protist family tree to try and get a broader picture. The researchers then grew up these protists in the lab and explored their genes by implanting foreign DNA. By modifying their DNA and monitoring how the protist behaviour, function, or biochemistry changed, the researchers are beginning to learn what these genes do. Now, to do this, they had to use a variety of methods to get this foreign DNA into the protists, including shooting in minute DNA-coated particles of gold or tungsten, or zapping the cells with electricity to make their membranes more permeable. This all sounds straightforward enough, but the researchers then had another problem. In some cases, the protist would identify this foreign DNA as an intruder and clear it out of the cell before it could be translated into a protein or integrated into the DNA. There were so many hurdles to overcome, it was essential to have such a large, wide-ranging team involved in the research. Genes were successfully added to 13 of the 39 protists originally chosen. Hopefully, this will be a great contribution to the field, and other microbiologists will be able to use these methods going forward for further experiments. The work was funded by a philanthropic organisation that supports research about microbes in the environment, called the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation. They awarded the research group with $8 million to close the gap in knowledge about protist genomes, and hopefully these findings will facilitate future research and kickstart more in the field.
My final story is a bit of a warning. A group of researchers from Lincoln have been investigating the possible link between growing urbanisation and the rise in the total number of disease outbreaks per decade since the 1980s. Urban expansion at the periphery of cities, also called extended urbanisation, is fundamentally altering how millions of people live and interact with each other and with nature. The group of researchers have warned that this is creating a huge number of new ecological niches for microbes and could lead to the spread of infectious disease. The new suburban areas created were found to be much more likely than cities to be the source of new and re-emerging infectious diseases. They are particularly vulnerable to zoonotic diseases, or diseases that spread from animals to humans, as they bring populations of humans and livestock into contact with displaced wildlife that doesn't really happen in cities. They are often densely populated, poorly planned, lacking health infrastructure, and out of sight of government authorities as well. It's an area that's been pretty understudied, and the researchers say that a better understanding of the changing spatial relationships between cities, suburbs, countrysides, and the factors that shape these changes will be key to reducing the risk of future outbreaks of infectious disease and limiting their spread when outbreaks do occur.
Something about this lockdown has brought out the green fingers in a lot of us, and more of those fortunate to have the opportunity to are taking up gardening. My last story of the day is going to be about the microbes that live in the soil and what they do to attract invertebrates. Streptomyces are a group of soil-dwelling bacteria that produce a chemical called geosmin. Now, you may not have heard of geosmin before, but you'll definitely be familiar with its unmistakable earthy smell. Until recently, it wasn't really known why Streptomyces produced geosmin and another strongly scented compound, 2-methylisoborneol. Theories about signalling the bacteria's toxicity to other compounds was considered, especially because Streptomyces are often powerful antimicrobials. Turns out, though, that these compounds are used by the bacteria to attract tiny invertebrates called springtails. So Streptomyces release spores to spread and propagate to new environments, and these springtails are the perfect vector for carrying their spores. The bacteria produce more geosmin and 2-methylisoborneol when they are producing spores. Springtails are attracted to the smell of these compounds, and when they approach, the spores stick to their bodies or are spread in their feces. Interestingly, other invertebrates and arachnids were not attracted to Streptomyces or the chemicals that they released.
Thanks for listening. As always, if you've enjoyed the episode, don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe on your podcast provider. In the meantime, we hope you're staying safe, and we'll see you on the next episode.